across the galaxy and into your dwelling. It's the Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast that explores every corner of the Star Wars universe.
All right, bro. First and foremost, I have no idea how to play Holo Tactics, so that's clearly why you've won 26 rounds. This is embarrassing.
27, but you're getting the hang of it, dude. You're starting to figure out Holo Tactics. It'll come to you.
I don't even know. I keep pushing this button, and it doesn't work.
The purple one?
So I think that the table that you got is faulty.
I mean, it was used, but I don't know if it was loaded.
Yeah, well, we'll agree to disagree. Maybe we should give this up and get something started that's of value here, for Pete's sake.
Absolutely. Let's do what we're good at, or we think we're good at.
Actually, CB, can you bring in a recording device? I feel like in here is one of the best places, especially when it comes to putting together a strategy where we can talk about one of the best strategists, militarily speaking, to come out of Mandalore in many generations.
What? Oh, were you talking to me that whole time?
Yes. CB, can you bring in a transmitter for us to be able to transmit in the game room here, please?
Oh, yes. Your wish is my command, Al. Coming right up.
Thank you very much. And if you could do it next time with a little less sarcasm, I'd appreciate that, CB.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, clearly you're not listening. All right, let's go ahead and get this thing all set up. Michael, are you ready?
I am so ready. Let's do this.
All right. Transmitting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast where we explore every corner of the Star Wars galaxy, one topic at a time. I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Michael Howarth, and today we are talking about Bo-Katan Kryze, or Lady Bo-Katan, if you follow her regal youthhood.
Regal youthhood. Is youthhood a word?
No, it's definitely not. I was like, I just barreled right into that word that doesn't exist. Yeah, her youthhood.
I appreciate it. I like that.
Let's talk about Bo-Katan.
It sounds like something that would be given to a young child when they've become of age back in like an ancient culture. They received their youthhood.
Yeah,
and they would wear it
exactly.
Whenever they went out into public.
They've arrived at youthhood. So Bo-Katan. So, we're going to talk about her.
Yeah, so for those of you who are jumping into the Smuggler's Dispatch right off the bat, this is your first episode. First of all, I'm sorry, and you can find something else if you want to.
Yeah.
But if you are wanting to stay on the line, we have actually decided that we're going to be going through a little bit of a Mandalorian series. Two episodes ago, we covered basically the story of Mandalore and where the Mandalorian culture came from a behind-the-scenes perspective. Last episode, we covered how we can understand the Mandalorian culture more through the leader Satine Kryze. And this episode, we are actually going to cover our second of three in our Mandalorian exploration, which is Bo-Katan Kryze, who is the sister of Satine. Yep. And again, if you want to listen to hear more about that topic, then I highly recommend that you go back and listen to our previous episode. Now, also keep in mind, before we jump in here, these are part of our casual cantina approach. So again, for those of you who may not be familiar, whenever you see that new casual cantina tile come up on your feed, these are more laid back episodes. We don't have a ton of strict. Yeah, exactly. We don't have a ton of historic structure that we've got where we're like, okay, this is the behind the scenes. This is some fun facts. This is the did you knows. This is the significance. This is us going more freeform, more jazz of sorts.
Ooh, yeah.
And there's
cool,
I think there's a lot
smooth
of value. I was actually thinking acid.
Oh, good. Acid jazz.
Yeah. Yes. I don't really know what classifies acid jazz, but
dude,
it always sounds so edgy.
You know the official canon type of music that Figurin Dan and the Modal Nodes play?
What is it?
It is officially jizz, is what that is called. Look, I mean, it's on Wikipedia, you know? Oh, Figrin, Dan, and the modal notes. Here we go. Wikipedia. Hold on. here we go. Hold on. Al is still just like dying over there. I can't believe you didn't know that.
That no, it's is because I keep thinking incredible. Of jokes to go down horrible rabbit
yeah, hole. Yeah, I know. I kind of wanted to back you into a corner there on our PG podcast.
Well, if it's canon, it's canon.
Yeah. there's a whole Wikipedia page about it. Woo! It's rich.
How do they spell it?
J-I-Z-Z. Jizz was a genre of music. Jizz Whalers. Jizz Whalers were musicians who specialized in the genre. Max Rebo and his band were popular Jizz Whalers. Dude, Jizz was first mentioned in canon in Star Wars Return of the Jedi Junior novelization, authored by Ryder Windham. Oh boy. Ryder Windham just getting that one right past the editors, landing it solidly in Wikipedia.
Oh my word. This is such torture.
Oh wow,
that is the style of these podcasts, so hopefully that clarifies that to you. To our casual
y'all, when we say laid back, we mean ooh, real laid back around
yes,
here. That
exactly,
that's the best trivia I think I've ever gotten in Star Wars. In all of Star Wars.
I know.
Wow,
I it's good.
That one
it's
will stick with me for years. For many years.
I know, it sounds made up, but yeah, notes. It's real. Those modal nodes, yep. And Max Reeves, you know, the big blue puffy guy.
Blasting. I cannot go anywhere with a PG podcast. A PG podcast.
Oh, there's nothing.
So Bo-Katan.
Yes.
Bo-Katan.
We're here. We have arrived. Yeah, so like I was saying, these three episodes are, we're trying to understand Mandalore through its people. So understanding more of the culture of Mandalore yeah. through its people. And these three people, so we're doing, like you said, Din Djarin, Bo-Katan, and Satine, all kind of embody different aspects of what makes these Mandalorian people who they are. And a couple of the things we've kind of come across is their loyalty and their absolute dedication to their faith. There were some of the things, and not even necessarily a faith, but they're just very...
Their belief, that whatever their belief is, whether it is a religious faith or if it's a conviction
that's
or something along
is.
Those lines.
Conviction. That's the word I was looking for. That's kind of what everything boils down to that we have discovered in our journey is the conviction of the Mandalorian people, whether that's to pacifism or whether that's to their warrior history or if that's to their traditions, then all those things are kind of baked into being a Mandalorian.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's explore Bo-Katan Kryze and her position here. So first, Michael, who plays the character of Bo-Katan Kryze?
So Bo-Katan is played by Katie Sackhoff, who was also in Battlestar Galactica and a few other sci-fi shows I'm not super familiar with. But the fun thing is,
which did you have you watched BSG, bro?
Dude, I haven't gotten down into the BSG. I've seen some of the old episodes with like the wobbly sets and whatnot, which is sweet.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't watched the new one. Is it good? I've heard good things.
I think you'd like it. I think you'd like it. I mean, I haven't made it through the entire series because it's beefy. It is.
Yeah,
it
that's
is
what
a
I've
beast.
Heard. I think isn't her character Starbuck? I think she's Starbuck in it.
Yes.
Which is kind of fun.
And she's a little baby in it. Like she's very
really?
Young in that show. Because that show's old. That show's very old. I mean, I believe that it premiered on Sci-Fi, and it feels very, very Sci-Fi Network.
Right.
Like early 2000s Sci-Fi, which I love.
It is, yeah.
So if people
is.
Out there have not seen Battlestar Galactica, watch the remake. The first two episodes are technically not really episodes. They're like a feature-length film.
Like a made-for-TV
into,
movie.
Yeah. And it's actually really good. It's enjoyable. It kind of helps you understand where we're at in the timeline of Battlestar. So I think that it's definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
So she first appeared when in canon of Star Wars?
So Katie Sackhoff's Bo-Katan shows up for the first time in 2012, which may seem like a lot longer ago than you would have thought if you've only seen her in live action.
Yeah.
Because Bo-Katan has been in The Clone Wars. She has been in Star Wars Rebels. She has been in The Mandalorian. And a lot of folks only know her from The Mandalorian. But one of the really cool things is that the voice actor has always been Katie Sackhoff, who is also the actor. So she was able to bring
a
voiced character into life in live action, which we have seen our animated characters come to life a lot recently, thanks to Dave Filoni. But we don't usually get to see their actual voice actor become the character themselves, and a lot of
yes,
the times
which I
go ahead
oh I was just gonna throw out and say I'm watching through, because all of my friends are bullies, I'm watching through Rebels right now.
Good.
And another one that I noticed is Forrest Whitaker as Saw Gerrera, that Forrest Whitaker lent his voice in the
yes.
Rebels series and then became Saw Gerrera not only in the live action Rogue One, but he also made an appearance as a motion capture in Jedi
right
Fallen Order.
Yes, yeah. I forgot he actually did Fallen Order, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
To be fair though, his Clone Wars character is voiced by a different person.
But Rebels
he's
is
young.
Not.
He's
Rebels.
Yeah, Rebels is him.
Yeah, Rebels is Forrest yep. Whitaker.
Because he's kind of come into, he's left his like angsty younger days, and he's become the actual Saw Gerrera that we know and love from Rogue One and Andor. He is so
which
good in
do
Andor.
We love? Do we love Saw Gerrera? I mean,
we
just gonna
love
say that.
Saw Gerrera. We love.
Do you
love him, dude? Talk about somebody who could have been a Mandalorian at heart. Saw Gerrera. He is full of conviction. Just he's got it in spades.
But I also think that Saw Gerrera is kind of towing the line of maybe being a little bit too zealous to the point of being willing to do evil for the sake of good. He's an anti-hero in that way.
Well, of course, and that's what makes him really interesting, I think. Oh, man, now we need to do an episode on Saw Gerrera. I haven't even thought about this. He's so good.
And a lot of people are like, Saw Gerrera who? But yeah, you need to check it out. First of all, he's got a ballin' name. I mean, Gerrera.
It's awesome. Dude, and I mean, Forrest Whitaker is just such a good actor. Like, the gravitas that he brings to the character. Like, and he brings his craziness. Like, remember when Jyn Erso first approaches him and then he's trying to suss out whether or not she's there as a spy for the Empire or something? He's like, have you come here to kill me?
What I love is Saw in his younger days. He's definitely full of all that and the stuff from the modal nodes. But he also then becomes. I mean, Forrest Whitaker. Well, this episode isn't about Forrest Whitaker, by the way. Everybody.
Yeah, but it's a casual cantina.
Forrest Whitaker's
so
like,
we're allowed.
Yeah,
to.
He's exactly. We're just playing our favorite genre of
flavor.
audible jazz.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I think is great about Forrest Whitaker is he is actually like a very dramatic actor.
Oh yeah.
And it surprised me that he was lending his voice to Rebels first.
Right.
And it didn't surprise me to see him in Rogue One, because that's definitely a heavy beast.
Well,
but
his
in a kid's
I mean, Rebels
show,
was
like Rebels.
Post Rogue One. So his character had already been, he had been established as Saw Gerrera.
But the fact that he was willing to actually continue on in the animated series vocally, I think is very impressive.
It is really cool. Dude, Rebels got a lot of people. They got James Earl Jones, actually, to do voices. Also, the Clone Wars got, towards the end of there, they got Liam Neeson for a couple Force Ghost Qui-Gons, which is pretty sick.
Which... I'm pretty sure that James Earl only did that because he had like a new yacht to pay for.
Like, in Rebels? No, dude, it's because he loves it.
But I need a ship.
It's so cool. I mean, he pops up. I think it's the very first or second episode of Rebels. James Earl Jones is there as Vader, which is so dope.
That is pretty cool. One day we'll just be able to hear his voice via AI.
Yeah, I know.
Be like, this is James Earl Jones' robot of
well,
a robot.
Well, I mean, that's how they did Luke in Book of Boba Fett. That's not actually, like, some of it is Mark Hamill's dialogue, but that most of that is AI generated from a collection of Mark Hamill's younger dialogue.
That's insane.
Yeah,
that's,
and it worked
just
pretty
insane.
Well. Dude, okay, check this out. Now we're going to segue from Mark Hamill in The Mandalorian back into Katee Sackhoff as Bo-Katan.
Michael, you've been practicing
I've
your
been
segues, and that's perfect.
This. I planned this out since the very first Figuring Dan in the Modal Nodes conversation, our segue. This is like when I take a wrong turn when I'm driving, which happens every time I drive, and I accidentally find myself back on the road that I meant to come to. And I was like, oh. Perfect.
I meant this.
That's
look,
exactly
now,
what
we're
I meant
where
to
I
do.
Thought we were gonna
yeah,
be.
Yeah, exactly. But okay, so Katee Sackhoff plays Bo-Katan. She didn't get to meet Mark Hamill on set of The Mandalorian. In the scene where we haven't met Luke yet, and he flies in the X-wing, and he comes to save Din and everybody from the Dark Troopers and from Moff Gideon. You remember that epic finale where he flies in
yes.
and his hood's up and nobody knows who it is. So Dave Filoni famously loves Plo Koon, the Jedi Plo Koon. So he wrote in
yes.
that this would be Plo Koon. He even had the art department create like art for these scenes as Plo Koon. Everything up until the day of shooting was Plo Koon. In this, like, nobody knew that it was going to be Luke Skywalker. So Katee Sackhoff, like, didn't come into work that day to hang out on set because she thought it was just going to be somebody in, like, a motion capture suit and that it wasn't actually going to be going to be Mark Hamill. So she didn't come in, and she didn't know until the episode aired that Mark
oh my
Hamill,
gosh.
That it was going to be Luke. She sees it, and she was texting Dave Filoni as she was watching the episode, like, are you kidding me? It's not Plo Koon. Like, I didn't get to meet Mark Hamill because
that's
you
insane,
lied to
because
my face
Katee
and told
Sackhoff
me it was
Well, and Katee Sackhoff's dad was like a huge Star Wars fan.
Oh, really?
That then he like gave her that heritage, and that's something that they shared together, and that's why Katee Sackhoff was so stoked
that's awesome.
To be part of Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so yeah, it only makes sense that the wound would be even deeper. And so speaking of that, where can we find Bo-Katan's storyline? We'll just pepper it in and let us know like
yeah.
what locations in the canon we can, for somebody who wants to learn just about Bo-Katan,
oh,
where do
totally.
They watch?
So if you're looking for a history of Bo-Katan, you're going to want to start with the Clone Wars, which is where she first shows up as a part of the Death Watch as a Night Owl. Book of Boba Fett references her maybe, but she's not actually in Book of Boba Fett, and then The Mandalorian live action, and she's also in Star Wars Rebels, sorry, which I skipped over. That would be after Clone Wars. So Clone Wars, Rebels, Mandalorian, that's where you want to go to find her. They're all played by Katee Sackhoff, which is very exciting. I think she first shows up towards the middle, so like season 4-ish of Clone Wars. And she's not.
Yeah,
like
I haven't gotten to her yet, and I'm middle of season 3 right
wait,
now.
Wait. You're doing Rebels though.
Oh, you
said
Clone
about
Wars.
Rebels.
Yeah, sorry.
So Clone Wars season 4, yep. She shows up. She's a part of Death Watch. She's not necessarily a good guy. We get to see a cool progression there. We talked a bit about her in our last episode as well about Satine. But yeah, she comes up pretty much from then on out in the Clone Wars, but she's really important in season 7 during the Siege of Mandalore when she's working alongside Ahsoka, which is some of the coolest Star Wars you can possibly lay your eyeballs on is season 7 of the Clone Wars. So watch the Clone Wars just to get to season 7 even. It's amazing. And then Rebels season 4 as well. So actually easy to remember. Both season 4 is where she shows up. So if you want to go back and just get your Bo-Katan on, season 4 has gotcha.
I love it. I think that's perfect. So now that we can assume that you paused this episode and decided to watch all of those episodes to get
yep,
caught on,
as you
caught
should.
Up on Bo-Katan, let's talk about who she was. And that's something that I think is really important for the overall understanding of the place of Mandalore in the Star Wars canon, is to look at its people
yeah.
and especially at its leaders. And Bo-Katan is one of its most controversial leaders. And speaking of which, just like all leaders, they usually come from a royal family, and Bo-Katan
yeah.
definitely did. because when you listen to our previous episode where we're talking about Satine Kryze, we learn that Bo-Katan and Satine are sisters, and they are basically diametrically opposed to one another's philosophical standpoints, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. When we're first introduced to Bo-Katan, we don't know that they're sisters, and she is actually roasting Satine publicly, not literally, like on a spit, but you know, like a rap battle roast.
That comes later.
But, yeah, exactly. So she's saying, you know, that Satine and the government of Mandalore have failed to protect their people, and Death Watch are the ones that came and brought all these hoodlums to justice. That's kind of how we first are introduced to her. So you have no idea that they're sisters, and it's kind of a little bit of a twist that you find out a couple episodes later that they are related.
It's a good reveal. It's a very good reveal. Well, and speaking of that, another facet of Bo-Katan is, I mean, we see her in... When we first get introduced to her in the Clone Wars, she's kind of a terrorist.
Oh yeah,
like that's really what she is. But one thing that I want us to think about with respect to Bo-Katan is she's almost a terrorist in some ways that it could be argued in the way that the early American revolutionaries were seen as terrorists to the British Empire. It's terrorism from a certain perspective, but
from
you
a
really
point
do
of view.
Yeah, exactly, but you really do understand why she is battling against Satine, and kind of explain again for those who didn't listen to the Satine episode, explain where Satine Kryze took the Mandalorian people and why Bo-Katan was fighting against her her leadership.
So Satine was the Duchess of Mandalore. She kind of inherited and grew up through a grassroots movement to have control over the planet from like a government standpoint. And she was an extreme pacifist. So she refused to join the Republic, refused to join the Separatists, and always wanted to maintain Mandalore's independence because she believed that it would have its most strength there as a people. But she got a lot of pushback from that. She had support because all of the wars of their past had kind of destroyed their planet and their people. So it was kind of split pretty much seems like 50-50, the people that supported the old ways and the people that supported her pacifism. But her sister, Bo-Katan, was definitely not in support of that pacifism. She thought that Mandalore needed to dominate and to show their strength and to go back to their warrior ways. And a lot of people believe that the reason that things were falling apart for them was because they had forsaken their history and their heritage. So they were on totally opposite ends of the spectrum, although from the same family, both royalty as well.
Well, and I think that that's one of the great things to look at with Bo-Katan is she is so on the opposite end of the spectrum than her sister that we get a really good balance between those two.
Yeah.
And we see the tension, and we can understand that from a sibling standpoint.
Right.
That a lot of times siblings are diametrically opposed, but there's also common threads that bind them together. And I think that their love for Mandalore, I would have loved to see Mandalore ruled by Satine and Bo-Katan simultaneously.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I think that would have been perfect. That would have been the best way for them to rule the planet. And I think they could have done it while still remaining independent, but not necessarily purely pacifist. But yeah, and I think, you know, it's a good call out that she was kind of a terrorist with the Night Owls as a part of the Death Watch, which is her subgroup was the Night Owls, and that's why she has that's why she has the owl eyeballs like on her helmet.
Yeah.
Which is very cool. So, and you'll also see you'll see that a couple other places, like actually Sabine Wren, also Mandalorian, has a Night Owl like on her shoulder pauldron. She isn't a part of that, but it might be partially for that, for Bo-Katan and Mandalore. But yeah, she's kind of a terrorist, but also like I like the idea of her being more of a vigilante or more of a what was the word you used for the people in 1776? A revolutionary. She's more of a revolutionary.
A revolutionary.
Whereas Saw Gerrera is more of a true terrorist, which makes him more of a morally difficult character. With Bo-Katan.
Yeah, ambiguous or even potentially corrupt.
Right.
Bo-Katan is not corrupt.
Well, I think corrupt is the wrong word for Saw, because Saw is single-mindedly focused. He's like, he will
but I
never
think that he's
give up his ideals.
I don't mean like politically corrupt. I think that he's corrupted himself. I think that he's corrupted his morals
in order
to be willing to go however far he needs to without apology.
Yes.
In that way.
I think he's such an interesting character, though. Him and Luthen Rael from Andor as well. Like, remember Luthen's monologue talking about how he has given up everything that makes him human to basically keep the rebellion alive, that like he is a bad person, but the rebellion needs him? That is the most interesting type of character. I love that. Ah, sorry.
Yeah, well, one of the good things to come out of Andor.
Oh my god.
Well, yeah, so I definitely, but I think that in that echelon, you see that Bo-Katan does not fall on the moral ambiguity. I think Bo-Katan has a very, for the most part, has a very strict moral compass.
She's easier to root for sure.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that's really interesting is once we get into The Mandalorian, we start to see an even newer side of Bo-Katan. So in Clone Wars, at least, I can't speak for Rebels, but in Clone Wars, again, Bo-Katan is a lot more like Satine, that she is a character that enhances other people in the story. She's kind of a side character.
Right.
But believe it or not, in The Mandalorian, in season two, when she appears, you actually start to see the character of Bo-Katan Kryze become somebody more dynamic, especially in her meeting with Din Djarin, which, again, we have to keep in mind, Din Djarin is a purist. Din Djarin is dogmatic. He is very fundamentalist in his approach to Mandalorian culture and into Mandalorian religion.
Right.
And you find Bo-Katan, who I would actually argue, this is really interesting now that I think about it, Bo-Katan is set, I'm going to say something that's potentially controversial, and it's good that we keep talking about Saw Gerrera because he actually serves a purpose
in all of this.
See,
it all works out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think that Bo-Katan, when you see her at the beginning of season, or when she first appears in season two, she could be set down the path of how do I say this, potential corrupt approach, that she could be going down the Saw Gerrera path, that she's like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get my end result, and it doesn't matter how I get there.
Yeah.
And I think that the thing that stops her from doing that is her interactions with Din Djarin.
Mm. Interesting.
I think her interaction with Din Djarin absolutely changes her path when you think about it in season two.
Maybe, yeah. I could see that. I'd have to go back and rewatch it to keep my eyes peeled for that and to go over their interactions again. But yeah, I didn't get that sense. My sense was that her character is pretty well established, like not as a story character, but her personal character is pretty solidified. But I think that how she, you know, I think how bitter she is about the things she's lost in Mandalore and the history and like all like the way she comes across to me, that defensiveness and how she's very flippant and writes all these things off shows how hurt she is and how, you know, how good of a person she is deep down. Like, these things really did affect her, and the only way for her to keep them from destroying her is to pretend like she doesn't care about them, you know? But no, I think that opened that up for her again.
I think there could be an argument to what you're saying, but I also, and I think you and I disagree on this, I see Bo-Katan as a skeptic, especially with like the Children of the Watch. And I think that we see her as a skeptic to the dogmatic approaches that Mandalore has adopted.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
How do I say this? On the whole. And that's where I think that it's really interesting to see how Bo-Katan is really opened up through her interactions with Din Djarin to the beauty of tradition. Because I think Bo-Katan isn't cutting herself off because it's like a... I think she's genuinely jaded. I think she's disenfranchised at that point with Mandalorian culture and the where Mandalore or what Mandalore is defined as. And I don't think that Bo-Katan understands when we find her at the beginning of season two of Mandalorian. I don't think that she knows what she really wants to fight for Mandalore, but she knows that she wants to fight. She's got a passion, but she doesn't necessarily have a direction. And I think that that's what's cool is her interactions with Din Djarin actually give her a purpose. It gives her a direction. It gives her something to fight against. Whereas in her first interactions, I mean, let's be honest, she's pretty much just angsty. When we see her in season two of Mandalorian, she's just like, oh, I'm angsty, I'm filled with anger, but it's just towards the analogous empire, but I don't know the post-empire, I don't know who to fight anymore.
Yeah.
And, but she also, I mean, she calls the Children of the Watch a cult. She just kind of lays it out, and she's like, we don't follow your psychotic ways.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, well, I like what you were saying before. Yeah, her cynicism, I think, about the whole thing is because she's seen dogmatism fail on both ends of the spectrum. She's seen the dogmatism of, you know, a pure pacifist ideology fail her sister. And she's seen the dogmatism of people who are only solely committed to the old ways fail with the Death Watch. So, you know, the Children of the Watch and Din Djarin is just another flavor of absolute dogmatism that she thinks is really stupid. She makes fun of it. Like, you know, when I love the evolution of the this is the way. I really like listening to Bo-Katan say this is the way from when she's first introduced up until she sees the Mythosaur and she's talking with the Armorer. Because there's kind of this, it's pure sarcasm at the beginning. You know, she says it to Din Djarin as a joke and he maybe doesn't even get it and says it back to her. And then later on, like you start, she's such a good actress that, you know, you start to see that she's, it starts having meaning to her. And she's like, maybe I do. Maybe it has more like weight to it than I first gave it credit for. Because when she says this is the way towards the end after, you know, the Armorer, she tells the Armorer that she sees the Mythosaur and she gets the signet. Like it starts having a lot more reality to her, which is cool. But
well, and I think that, I mean, a couple of things that you point towards in there is, again, like we've got here, that she's a realist. That I think that Bo-Katan is a realist. She understands both sides of the coin. She understands the dogma on both sides caused the downfall of Mandalore. But when she does have that, experience with the Mythosaur, she when faced with the facts, when faced with the evidence, she doesn't create. She doesn't dig her heels in and say, I'm not going to believe, even though I've been faced with the evidence and the truth. Instead, she's going to say, I'm going to be open now to the possibilities of something that I once thought was myth or metaphor actually being true. And in a way, that's what's so cool about Bo-Katan is even the Armorer believe that the Mythosaur was just a metaphor. And I think she even says that in there. I think in the season, the Armorer says that the Mythosaur is a metaphor.
Yeah.
And Bo-Katan says it's not a metaphor.
She kind of alludes to that, yeah.
And Bo-Katan says, no, you're wrong. The Mythosaur is real. And it's that moment where Din Djarin goes in with his pure, unadulterated, what she sees as dogmatic faith, and she follows in, and by following him in his what she sees as a dogmatic faith, I think she is then transformed as a result, which I think is really I think that's really interesting, because I still have this theory that the watch that Din Djarin is part of, I think is still a cult. But I think Din Djarin is one of the people who's actually one of those cult members that you talk to and you're like, you really actually believe in the cause and not the leader.
Yeah,
and
that's, exactly.
That, which is really conflicting when you think about it.
As
like
a cult.
To have a, well, as somebody on the outside of a cult, when you're talking to somebody who that cult actually has some really good ideals, how conflicted are you when that cult follower believes in the ideals more than the cult itself? It transcends the cult, which I think is just a fascinating anthropological exploration.
Well, I do think that that's kind of, I know that there's a lot more differentiators between a cult and a religion, but I think that a religion built around, or you know, a group of people who have ideals and it's based around primarily that, just the ideology, is closer to a religion rather than built around just one specific individual, which it feels more like a cult. And it is interesting because the you know, the armorer is cult leader-esque, but it's also her job to just preserve the legends and lores of Mandalore. And she's kind of got these people that have surrounded her. Maybe she didn't even surround herself with them. So, yeah, I think the lines blur a little bit between religion and cult.
Which I'm going to say this too. Y'all, we actually recorded an episode with two of our really good friends, Michael and Kelly Canning, and we went deep into Mandalorian conversation. We decided not to release the episode because we went against our own best judgment and we didn't record the episode, or we didn't wait to record the episode until after Mandalorian Season 3 was done.
Yeah, and a lot of speculation.
I'm gonna just throw my hat out there and say I am so insanely guilty of saying we're not gonna speculate. And what did I do that entire conversation?
I speculated. Right.
But I think one of the big things...
You were pretty wrong, though, weren't you? About your speculation?
I was 50-50. I was 50-50. Okay. Because... And the jury's still out, and that's why I bring this up, is because
about
my speculation
armor?
Was... Yeah, my speculation was that the armorer was corrupted, and the armorer was, which we read multiple articles. Michael, you have to admit this. We read multiple articles that were talking right before the finale that there was something fishy about the armorer, that the armorer was going to be doing something. And
yeah, but
I
could
still
also just
think,
be, maybe that fish was a red herring, Al.
Only time will tell. I'm reserving judgment because, again, there's so many things in that story that say that that character, and I thought about adding the armorer as part of one of these exploratory episodes, but she needs her own episode down the line because she's so complex, and we need to see the how do I say this, the fruition of her story before she can be spoken on.
Yeah,
on
I could agree
level.
With that. I also think that, you know, the purpose of the armor, if we were to dive into her as a character that helps us understand Mandalore, is ancient history and like what Mandalore used to be and what these kind of dogmatic ideals boiled down to a small group of people, if you really take just the core fundamentalist ideologies. But I think Din Djarin is a more interesting character to present that because he's even more like, he believes the Mythosaur is real, 1,000%. Believes that much more than the armorer does. So I think that he's actually a better embodiment of the ancient preserved ideology of Mandalore than the armor. So I'm glad we're talking about him instead. But, and also I think the armorer from a plot perspective is, she's kind of just a vessel for, you know, these ideals. She's not necessarily as much of an interesting character to herself like Din Djarin is. Din Djarin also holds all these beliefs and ideals, but his story evolves, like his character evolves, I think, a lot more than the armorer.
Well, and you know what I think is really interesting? As you talk here, I've just kind of had this like aha moment that I think that Dave Filoni had years ago that now we're starting to see unfold is, if you think about it, all of these characters in Mandalorian culture serve to the growth of Bo-Katan and not the opposite.
Right.
Think about her interactions with Satine. Satine serves to teach Bo-Katan that just pure pacifism doesn't work. Also, to just follow something so blindly without understanding other perspectives on that topic is dangerous. That's another thing that she learned with Satine.
Right.
The thing that we see with the armorer is that we understand that this character, that Bo-Katan is learning from the Armorer, that there is something to be said about the old ways, but yeah. not the old ways that, because I mean, think about it. Bo-Katan, when we meet her, she's a purist. She mm-hmm. is one following, trying to push the agenda of the old ways. But then she learns that there are certain things about the old ways that need to be done away with, which right. is what she also gets from Satine. But she also realizes that there's certain things that need to be held on to, which mm-hmm. is what she gets from the Armorer. She also right. gains a new understanding of what it means to be Mandalorian through Din Djarin.
Through Din, yeah.
So I really do think that the whole story, now that I look at it from a holistic perspective, is centered around the growth of Bo-Katan. More than any other Mandalorian character we've ever yeah. seen. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I love that. And, you know, from looking at the show, The Mandalorian, I feel like Din and Grogu's story was very much wrapped up by the time mm-hmm. he says goodbye. When he sends yeah. Grogu off with Luke, I mean, I think, you know, that was even the original plan, was that Grogu was going to be gone. Like, he was going to go yep. off and become a Jedi working with Luke, you know, and we could assume that he eventually gets killed by Kylo Ren. But that was going to be the end. And I think that made a lot of sense. I think that was a natural ending. I feel like, you know, the fact that they were forced to bring Grogu back because he's such a juggernaut of a character and, you know... You could
awesome
be super
on lunch boxes.
Exactly. You could be really cynical and say the only reason they wanted him back was because they could market him, but they're going to market
That's
him anyway.
90% of the reason.
I mean, I do think that people are emotionally connected to him, and there are a lot of people who would watch the show just because, you know, they're like, oh, blah, 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 boring dialogue. And then there's Grogu. I just want to watch Grogu.
Which is
all day.
Marketing. The reason why they wanted yeah. to bring them back was for the marketing of the show, not just for merchandising.
Right. Well, and I mean, you have to market a show, obviously. You know, we don't get more stuff if people don't watch it. So I understand why they did that. I don't like it. I personally wish that they had kept that integrity to say, you know, he's gone. And then season three, The Mandalorian is not Din Djarin. Season three, The Mandalorian is Bo-Katan. And I think that
Which I think is, unpack that a little bit. Unpack that, because that's something you've talked about to me in the past. I don't think we've talked about it on the show. But yeah. explain that a little bit for listeners, that theory
well,
you have.
Yeah, I really like the idea that seasons one and two are so clearly about Din Djarin. They're about him understanding what it is to be a Mandalorian. They're about him understanding what it is to be a father, you know, what all these things mean, how we work together, what a family is, all classic Star Wars stuff that he learns. And it culminates in the end of season two of letting go of what you love, because that's what that person needs more than anything, is for you to let go of them, which I think was the hardest thing for Din to do. And that really completes the arc for Din and Grogu, in my opinion, I think, of their stories. And that was the Mandalorian story. In season three, we see this other Mandalorian, Bo-Katan, and how she is starting this progress and this process of learning and growing. And just like you laid out, we can look at all these stories and see how they all point back to Bo-Katan. So they really bring her into focus in season three, and her journey with the Darksaber, her journey with Moff Gideon, her journey up through, you know, uniting the children of the Watch with her Mandalorian group.
The lighting of the Great Forge.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Is the penultimate.
Right. Going
act.
Back to Mandalore, lighting the forge. Like, she takes on all these leadership roles and learns all these things along the way. And most importantly, is the one to reunite Mandalore. Like, she is reuniting the Mandalorian people and is becoming a leader. And that is the hardest thing for her to do, is to pick that mantle back up after losing her sister and after watching the entire planet get destroyed. And she feels like she's failed in every endeavor she's ever started. And season three of The Mandalorian is her. She is the Mandalorian in season three, in my personal opinion. Like, honestly, if you look at the primary story, Din and Grogu are like side quest folks. For sure, especially Grogu. And I think that just shows that they weren't even, you know, I think Din was supposed to be in it, but I don't think you can tell Grogu was never intended to even be in season three, which I think they do a good job of not sidelining Bo-Katan too much, because we still get the, you know, we still get the impact of her story, I think, which is really cool. But
and that's what I think that she literally and figuratively picks, like takes the torch and mm-hmm. runs it forward. And I also right. still, I mean, we need to talk about this one day on the podcast, how bizarrely season three ended. It was a very strange ending. I mean, because we were growing towards something, but it seems like a false end. It absolutely, yeah. I mean, it has to be a false end, because it seems like what we saw at the end of season three was a series finale.
Yes.
Is yeah. what it felt like. It was and they lived happily ever after.
I kind of hope it is. Like,
I don't know if it's gonna be this
quote, the Mandoverse, where Ahsoka's series is going to build as, you know, the, it's only going to be one season, this mini series of Ahsoka. And then we have a movie that's going to tie up, you know, Din Djarin, Bo-Katan, all these stories, Ahsoka, I'm sure Boba Fett will be in it too. So kind of this world, the sandbox that Dave Filoni has created will be tied up with a neat little bow as a movie at the end. And I hope we're done with the Mandalorian stuff. Not because I didn't love it, but because I loved it. I think it deserves to be self-contained, you know?
I think this is what I, and we're going to talk about something right now that's so not even Star Wars, but that's what I love about the show Ted Lasso.
Right.
Ted Lasso was great because it said, you know what, three seasons and that's it. We are the biggest show in the world right now, but all you're getting is three seasons and it's done.
I totally agree. And if you have
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, if you have like a shtick that can get old, like if you think your audience is capable of growing weary of what makes your show funny, which I think Ted Lasso is hugely in that category, then it's a really wise choice. The last thing you want to do is go off air six seasons later when everybody's like, oh, I'm just so sick of it, you know?
Oh, but see, I think that, I mean, it's the same with The Office. I think that Ted Lasso was one of those where it was such a character-driven show that it could have had the opportunity to live on much longer, just like Mandalorian.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, the Mandalorian story could go on for many seasons and it would probably be extremely successful. So it's actually a bigger gamble and it's a bolder step to stop it and to sit with the integrity of the story that they set out to tell than just to create fan service. So I respect them for that. And so I'll be curious to see if it's done. I mean, if it's done, I'll be satisfied, but also if that's the way that Moff Gideon goes out, I'm going to be a little underwhelmed. I mean,
in a
because
fireball?
The reality is, but let's be honest, man, Star Wars is very notorious that unless you see the body, there is no guarantee that that person's dead.
Grand Inquisitor in Rebels. Toast. Completely toast. He dies in a fireball. Much similar. Very similar to that.
But wait, doesn't he come back? Isn't Grand Inquisitor in Mandalorian?
No. The Grand Inquisitor is the dude from Kenobi.
Oh, what? I'm mixing him up.
Which is before Rebels.
But remember, he came back in Kenobi and got ran through. And then you're like, we don't see a body.
Then everybody's
like, we don't see a body.
But he dies in Rebels. Yeah. What? Wait, what? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But, dude, perfect example of this. Darth Maul. Darth Maul, you did not see the body, and he was cut in half.
Dude,
speaking
of the Darth Maul fight.
There's just something.
Go ahead. Something what?
From a story perspective, if we see the end of Moff Gideon right there, then Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau were a little weak in their storytelling. I'm just going to say, from an objective storytelling standpoint,
I don't understand.
They built him up.
You want to kill him in a different way? I don't understand. Why do you have a problem with that?
Because his conflict isn't done. His storyline has not been fully realized. And so I think that if he comes back in the film, I'm going to make the prediction that he'll probably make his final appearance in the film. I mean, think about this. The perfect example of what I'm talking about of story disappointment is the character of Captain Phasma. Phasma's death in The Last Jedi was extremely dissatisfying because the arc was building and then they dropped the arc off, which we as human beings are innately designed for whatever reason, to follow specific satisfaction of storytelling.
Yeah.
And that did not satisfy the specific steps of storytelling that a great storyteller uses. And it was for subversion in The Last Jedi, but it was not for subversion in The Mandalorian. There's still more story to be told there. And yeah. I think that that story is going to be told.
I think Phasma is a bad example, though, because she was just a... They gave us Boba Fett again in the movies, basically. And they did it exactly yeah. the same way. I mean, she doesn't have a character arc like in the sequel trilogy, really. She's just a bad guy that gets killed twice. Like, there's really nothing. If you don't read the Phasma book, then you don't have any real reason to care about her story, right? I mean, I didn't.
But again, when does Boba Fett see his end? The third film.
Right.
The culmination of storytelling. It was for pure subversion that Rian Johnson did what he did.
But I think that's a little, like, formulaic to say a character that has no story arc needs to die towards the end. Like, is that I don't know because he did,
but
Moff
it's
Gideon
also
did die towards,
it,
at the end
it to me it's also like saying that the theory of relativity is gross because it's formulaic. No, there's a beauty and elegance in formula. Exists because it works.
No, but I don't understand where, if this is the last season of The Mandalorian, he died at the end. That's your formula.
Ta-da. I don't think Moff Gideon's dead, but what I'm saying is they didn't complete the story arc. That's what I'm saying is it's not because of where it was at in the line. It's the way that they served that narrative, that storyline.
Well, unpack,
dude.
That.
We instantly get the reveal. We follow him through from the end of season one through season two to season three to finally get the reveal that he's a cloner and he's just trying to clone the Force. And he's dead 7 minutes later. I don't buy that. Well, I do not buy that line of storytelling.
I will say that I don't think that was a surprise. I don't think that was a huge reveal. Okay, well let's look at it. So what is Moff Gideon? Moff Gideon's introduced season one. He's a Imperial remnant. He's a leader of the Imperial remnant. So we know that he wants to bring back the ways of the Empire. We see him then leverage his power within the Empire to try to get what he wants. So he's using his position within this organization to gather resources and to purely serve his own desires, which are power and control and the Force eventually. So, you know, he's building an army. He's building these dark troopers. He's building the dark trooper armor. He's trying to like take the most powerful aspect of every culture he runs across. So we have the Mandalorians with the Beskar, we have the Jedi with the Force. So he's just taking these things, and I think that's interesting. Oh, okay, this guy is only interested in his own progression, and then all of his hubris brings him to his own demise in a giant fireball. Which is fine.
But his hubris, but here's the reality is if you look at it from a pure story perspective.
Okay, tell me the pure story. That's what I'm trying to break down is the pure story perspective here, Al. Tell me.
Because what we're looking at is in the course of rising action in a story.
Okay.
You have the climax, and the climax is the most intense moment. There's nothing that can be more intense than that moment. It's the explosion. Or it's the right before the Death Star explodes. It's the blaster bolt that Luke Skywalker has one last chance to destroy. Mm-hmm. That's the crux of the pinnacle of action.
The story, right.
We did not get to see Moff Gideon's full power explored. We got a taste of Moff Gideon's full power explored, but we didn't get to see the sheer buildup and result and product of his evil empire outside of just a few droids that he created and himself being powerful. So again, only time's going to tell, but I think Moff Gideon's coming back. And I think that we're going to see that Bo-Katan's new reign is going to have to be challenged in some way. And I think that that's what we're going to see because, again, a character like Bo-Katan, and maybe this is that I mean, I could be totally wrong. This could be the dancing of on the Endorian moon at the end of Return of the Jedi. Right. But at the same time, it just doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel like their story's quite done yet.
I can understand the way you feel about that. Because Moff Gideon, I like him. I like the character. But yeah, it wasn't like super compelling to me the way that he went out.
And yeah, he's the Darth Vader of the series. And you don't, like, that would be Darth Vader just getting, that would be Darth Vader dying by in flying space. Off the side yeah, of the exactly. Death Star in episode 4. That's my complaint.
Well, okay, yeah, that's fair.
It leaves you wanting for a good purpose.
That's true. I guess there's like a cynical side of me that's like, I didn't, like, Moff Gideon doesn't do it for me completely. Like, I like the character. I really liked him in season one. Uh-huh. I think he's better when he's off screen more. I think he like starts to lose mystery the more the series goes on. Which
I would argue is the same with Darth Vader. That the more you see Darth Vader, the more you see a movie monster in general, the less scary they become. I think that's pretty much just the science of storytelling for sure.
One thing I'll say about Vader is that the more you learn about Vader, the more you realize that what you assumed about him is wrong. Because at the beginning, you assume Vader is ultimate power. And as the story goes on, you realize that he's more of a henchman, and then he's more being manipulated. And then Vader actually isn't the most powerful villain that you initially think he is, which I think makes him super interesting, because then you realize, like, what are all these ulterior motives he has? Like, where did he come from? Like, it makes him more interesting. With Moff Gideon, you find out he just is more and more powerful, and he desires all this power for himself, and it's a little bit more two-dimensional, which is fine, and like, he works as a villain, but it's not quite as interesting as Vader, obviously.
But we know Filoni and we know Jon Favreau, and we know that's not the best that they can offer, and they only ever offer the best they have.
Well, especially towards the end. The end is always very satisfying, and I know we've argued about this before, but I think that the end of Ahsoka is going to crush our souls because it's all written by Filoni. I do think Jon Favreau has a bit more of a simplistic approach to storytelling, which is fine. But I don't think it's going to blow our minds as much. Filoni is the king. And I think Favreau...
Michael, I don't think you've ever said something more ignorant.
Well, I don't... I do not misunderstand me. I love Jon Favreau. I would lick his shoes. But I'm just saying, as a storyteller, I don't think he is... I think he's half as good as Filoni. That's what I think. Which is still really good. But... I don't know if
you've just shown your hand. You've shown your hand, Michael. That's all I'm going to say.
The way what Filoni does is like you give him these two disparate things. You have the sequel trilogy that, you know, tons of people dislike, and then you have the end of Return of the Jedi. And he is building these like mycelium tendons of connection between those two things. And given solely to him, he's going to make that space between those two things make more sense. He's going to make us like the characters more. And everybody's going to like Return of the Jedi and the sequel trilogy more because of Filoni. He is he builds tendons. That's what he does, you know? He does such a good job with that stuff.
I don't disagree with that, but I find it inherently shocking that you believe that Jon Favreau is only half as good a storyteller as Dave Filoni.
I find it shocking that you find that shocking. Really?
I find it shocking that you find it shocking that I find it shocking that you...
Force lightning
only
everywhere.
Time will tell. only time will tell how...
And I like Jon Favreau a lot. I am so great. I love his energy. I love the fact that I think he is a
Jon Favreau single-handedly revitalized the Star Wars franchise with his storytelling. Period. I hate to tell you this, but The Clone Wars was canceled. Rebels was canceled.
Okay, yeah, but the reasons
the Mandalorian
for those things completely.
But what
different.
I'm not saying it's because of Dave Filoni's storytelling.
He is limited by people who refuse to watch animation because they are too, they don't understand. I've said this before, animation is a medium, it is not a genre. And there's people that don't understand that and won't watch animation, and that's where Dave Filoni's been limited. People are missing out on some of the best storytelling ever in Star Wars just because it's animated. Favreau already had a leg up because it's live action. Literally, he had 10 times as many viewers just because it was live action. I'd bet.
I don't disagree with that, but I would also say that Jon Favreau is one of the best storytellers to ever come out of Hollywood, period.
That is so bold.
And it's not just because it's bold, but think about it, man. Think about what he did. He came in and created Swingers. He created Couples Retreat.
The greatest movies ever made.
No, think about it. He said, I'm going to make a superhero movie, and he started the Marvel franchise.
Yeah.
Movie.
Yeah, Iron Man's good.
He said, I'm going to make a Christmas movie, and he made the greatest Christmas movie in the last 40 years.
Elf is a true masterpiece.
He said, I'm going to come in and help Disney with these live-action remakes, and he makes The Jungle Book, and he makes The Lion King, which have the most used technology and the most advanced technology in Hollywood history, period.
Yeah,
he then comes in and says, I'm going to do Star Wars.
He comes
in and revitalizes Star Wars with The Mandalorian, with a fully original story.
Uh-huh. Which I appreciate.
Who else in cinematic history has made those levels of impact across the genre of film?
I agree with you completely.
I love
so
that this
thankful.
Episode is so not Bo-Katan.
Oh, I know. We went full casual here. Oh, this is a taste, a little bit more of a taste of what Al and I do on the daily together. We just argue. It's arguing with love. We fight with love. But
we usually say the same things.
Yeah. We're just like, we can't express how we feel. We're just arguing the same points. No, I agree. I think at this point we do disagree, though, because I appreciate all those things that Jon Favreau did. But I think there's like a critical element that you're missing there. I think that the massive success of the almost all those things you mentioned. So we have Star Wars with The Mandalorian. We have live action Disney. And we have Iron Man. All of those things are built on a huge legacy that came before. And I personally think the reason that The Mandalorian works so well is because of this massive sandbox that's already been laid out by Dave Filoni.
By George Lucas. That then Dave Filoni stepped on.
Yes. And then... All right, fine. Yeah, there is a legacy there that George Lucas handed to Dave Filoni that then Dave Filoni... So he has this amazingly rich pool to draw from.
I think
from,
it's apples and oranges.
Which he also had with Marvel, which he also had. And I would also argue, this is going to make you mad, but I think Iron Man, Jungle Book, what was the other one you said? Lion
Elf.
King. Okay, I'm going to leave Elf out of this list, but I don't think those are like amazing. I think they just sell because they're going to sell anyway. The technology part, yes, I'll give you that. And I do think that that is a very George Lucas-esque thing to do, is to draw in that technology. But I don't think his movies are like mind-blowing. They're just kind of like, except for Elf, which
is great. Out of intellectual honesty, Michael, you have to at least concede that what you just said right there is subjective and not objectively true.
Oh, sure.
You have to concede that.
If I concede that, because you have to concede that Andor is better than everything Jon Favreau has put his hands on.
Oh. Oh.
Intellectually.
Here's what I think it comes down to. Honestly, I think that I've never compared Filoni and Favreau in this conversation. I was not the one who set that
it's
forward.
It's the thief of joy. That
was a Michael Howarth. I will say that I think that they're apples and oranges when it comes to storytelling, but I think that they're both master storytellers in their own right. And I think with their masterful storytelling, they both understand and they approach storytelling in a different way. You can't necessarily say because one storyteller chooses to get its tendrils out and connect all of these stories that that's a better story. You can say it's a different story and it creates a different effect. than somebody who follows a traditional arc that actually has more of an emotional approach instead of a tendrillic systemic approach. I don't think that you can compare those two and say that they both one has value over the other. It's like saying that a sedan has value over a truck or a truck has value over a sedan. They both serve very different purposes in storytelling, and so they can't be compared because that in of itself would be a travesty to try to put those two together.
Yes, I will concede that, Al. I concede that to you. I have a problem. I know comparison is the thief of joy, but I have to do it in my head. I need to get over that. I always compare everything. Like even
it's
when
hard
I was a
not
kid,
to though.
Yeah, it is. It's tough, and I need to kind of retrain myself to not do that. When I was younger, I used to, like when I was 13, 12, 13, I would only buy t-shirts for my favorite band because I wouldn't let myself wear shirts that weren't my favorite band because it would have felt like I was slighting my favorite band. I literally only had Green Day t-shirts for years. And then
there's
I thrice t-shirts
to unpack
and I got
psychologically
rid of all of my
Green
Day. I know it's bad. It's bad. It's good for my marriage, but it's not good for the rest of my life.
That is true. Val's got nothing to worry about as long as we see a Val shirt on you constantly. I think that trying to wrap all of this up into a weird psychotic bow. I think
Bo-ka-tan.
There it is. We just wrapped it up with a bow.
Oh my goodness. I love that.
I think what's really cool about the storytelling of Bo-Katan is it actually pulls together the two artists that we just spoke of.
Yeah.
Filoni and Favreau are weaving their stories together.
That's true.
Based on the characters of Bo-Katan, the Mandalorian, and of Ahsoka.
Yeah,
and so we're going to see these two
kind of
interplay together and bring what both of them do so well together into what I think this is speculation again. I think is going to be one of the best pieces of Star Wars material that we've seen cinematically in a very long time.
I'm very excited
for that.
I'm looking forward to it too. I think it's going to be great. And Bo-Katan and Ahsoka is. I mean, they're awesome together, and they already have like some really incredible screen time at the end of Clone Wars. So seeing them come back together in whatever this culmination of these stories is going to be very cool and also previously established, which I love. It's not going to be like it came out of the blue. So again, we've said it 1,000 times, but I think all this stuff is going to pay off so much more if you watch The Clone Wars and you watch Rebels.
Yes.
Go to the... If you don't like animated stuff, just go for purely the story. Try to stomach it. And I promise you the animation styles are going to fade into the background after the first season or maybe season and a half. Because, you know, a lot of people dislike the style of Rebels. It was done on a smaller budget. So a lot of the textures and things like that are stylized.
It's very grainy.
Yeah,
it's a lot of grain to cover
the point of like
things.
Kind of, you know, kind of noodle arms a little bit. It's a little noodle army.
Yeah.
You know, and that's
it's a lot of squash and stretch.
It is a lot of squash and stretch. A lot of armor plates bending around. So, you know, give them a little benefit of the doubt for budgetary constraints. Also, you know, you can take some hope that was all inspired by Ralph McQuarrie. A lot of the art style for Rebels came straight out of McQuarrie. So if you're a big McQuarrie fan, you're going to really like Rebels visually for that. But all that to say, this stuff is so fun to watch come to life. Like all the fans of Rebels watching Ahsoka, it is pure, giddy, unadulterated joy to watch this show because you're like, oh my gosh, that's Ryder Azadi, and he can't see the actual actor that played him, and that's Jai Kell, and it's the actor that played him, and that's all these things. And the Loth Cat puppet, Oscar worthy. So good.
Amazing. Amazing. Yep, I agree. I think that with this, we should probably wrap up this casual cantina.
Yeah. Sorry we took that. I think that I derailed some of that. That hover train was off the rail, and most of that's my fault. So some of these notes we didn't get to, but
I think that really what we need to come back to is to say that all of these things have value.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it teaches us, even more about Bo-Katan, which then teaches us even more about Mandalorian culture. And we can understand that the Mandalorian culture is not only defined by its fierce dedication to its ideals and its past, but also now finds that its past is what roots itself in the ground and creates a foundation for it to become a promising future. I think Bo-Katan is the first leader that we see coming out of Mandalore who actually has a potential to unite people of different backgrounds, of different belief sets inside of the Mandalorian culture, and make them all fight for the common understanding of a unified people. And I think that's what's so cool about Bo-Katan. And I realize now, after saying this, we probably should have used Bo-Katan as the third of these three, because Satine and Din Djarin kind of bow at the feet of Bo-Katan's superior ability to lead. I mean, to be completely honest, we're seeing the birth of one of the greatest leaders in Star Wars canon. And so with that, I really hope that if you have not followed the story of Bo-Katan Kryze, if this is a character that you may have never ever explored on your own, hopefully our fire and our vinegar that we put out there in this shows that we are passionate about this character, and she is absolutely worth your time. I would say that she goes down in the echelon of maybe the top 20 greatest Star Wars characters ever created out of this franchise. So please give her some credence. Now, with that, Michael, where can people find us?
So you can learn more about this episode and all of our other episodes at smugglersdispatch.com. CB has put together show notes, links, pictures, and more for you to peruse at your leisure. On Instagram and YouTube, we are also at Smugglers Dispatch, so go follow and check out the show there as well. We have plans to be adding some more things there. If you've been listening to all these episodes, we say that like every time that we have plans to use
YouTube.
But
we do have plans.
Someday,
we have lots of plans.
In the far future, hopefully there is just so much cool stuff on there that you can go find and check out, and hopefully we did what we said we would do. It'll be really cool. And
that's the goal.
Yeah. What else, Al?
Yeah. And so with that, we also want to hear from you. I mean, one thing that we love is some friendly ratings on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you like what you hear here, please feel free to leave us a review. We would love to hear your thoughts, your opinions. If you want to, you can also just email us at smugglersdispatch@gmail.com if you really want to give us a piece of your mind.
Please do.
We are happy to take your emails over there. Another thing that we have as a great option is over on smugglersdispatch.com. You can visit the website and click a little mic icon in the bottom right corner of the screen, and you can leave us a voicemail. We will listen to that. We will respond to that on air as long as it's school appropriate, and we will be happy to discuss and explore anything you have there. So feel free to ask a question, tell a story, whatever you want to share with us and the HoloNet at large. So with that, everybody, I would love to say thank you for tuning in. Our next episode is going to be covering Din Djarin. It's the final in the Mandalore series. So until then, may the Force be with you.
And may the stars light your way.